Today in Studio 360, what does it take to become a star?
At 15 years old, I had this dream of what I was going to do with my life. I actually had the audacity to carry that out. Discover.
35 years later, that's worked out pretty well for Michael Stipe, the lead singer of REM. And what happens when a superstar author spends 25 or 30 years trying and failing to write another great American novel?
That's what he couldn't make happen. And this is the key to the story of what happened to Bill Styron.
I talk with Alexandra Styron about her new memoir called Reading My Father. Plus, we finally reveal our radical new redesign of Monopoly.
I suggested Apple and Google as Park Place and Boardwalk.
I'm Kurt Anderson. All that and more is ahead today in Studio 360, right after this. We're in the money. Come on,
my honey. You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. And if you happen to be listening to the show for the first time in Houston on KUHF, welcome.
Houston is filled with promise. Laredo's a beautiful place.
On today's show, Michael Stipe of REM talks about his life in music, and Alexandra Styron takes on her father, the late great novelist William Styron. But first, the economy right now. Sluggish, uncertain. Except, of course, for the high-end financial industry, Wall Street. And what else? Well, another market headquartered in glammy precincts of Manhattan, the art market. The art auction season just wrapped up, and it produced some extremely bubbly results. The remarkable sales of paintings didn't just involve household names. The brand new It Boy is an artist named Jacob Cassay. Just last fall, his pieces were priced at around $8,000 a piece. But one of his paintings ended up selling at an auction this month for $290,000.
There was a kind of collective, I would call it a collective,
That's Sarah Douglas, the culture editor of the New York Observer. She's covered the art world and the art market for some time and knows as well as anybody how an art star gets created these days.
I guess when you're talking about Cassay's work in particular, it's a very interesting case because he's an artist who makes a lot of different kinds of work. A lot of it's monochromatic work, sort of post-minimalism, roughly.
Sort of nicely executed paintings of various black and white
that are abstract.
Yeah.
The work of his that has skyrocketed on the market is they've come to be known as the silver paintings. And it's quite interesting because you can kind of check off all the boxes on them. Okay, they're very
shiny.
They're shiny. I talked about in an article I wrote about him. I sort of said there's this idea that the owner of the piece can actually see a reflection of themselves in this object.
Yeah.
So there's something that...
Which is a wonderful, sick, modern idea.
Exactly. I mean, you can also talk about the idea of them as, you know, looking like these beautiful, almost luxury, distressed handbags that a woman would carry because the edges of them are burned through this alchemical sort of type process he uses to adhere the silver to the support.
So there's a kind of a familiar luxury craftsmanship involved.
Yes.
And if a purse sells for $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000, why not a painting that looks like a Chanel purse for $10,000?
Well, and I think, and you could say that, and that's somewhat cynical. But I think, you know, I don't know. It's also somewhat valid. If you went to his first exhibition in New York in 2009, he also had them stacked on the floor as though they were objects. So they really. They have this sort of, they have everything going for them in a funny kind of way.
And we can say all that now, explaining why his prices have gone through the roof and why he's suddenly in demand. However, playing not even devil's advocate, looking at his work in 2009, 2010, perfectly nice work, perfectly lovely, intensively worked over paintings and objects, but nothing amazing. Whoa, this guy is starting a new movement or he's done something nobody else has done. It seems a little random and arbitrary that this person's work, of all the young artists working, was sort of plucked and declared, you know, worth gambling on.
Right. And I think there you get into the issue of what has been called an artist's process of endorsement. There are the obvious signs of endorsement. Museum exhibitions. An art critic writes about your work favorably. Then there are sort of the market-related aspects, the dealer taking you on, the prices going up at auction. Uh-huh. And I think the idea of a market star is a more recent phenomenon where an artist's value is created in purely market terms.
Right.
And that's dangerous because if there's a situation where there's a bubble, that bubble can burst.
It is, and you say a bubble, it is. The art market does almost seem like a parody of the Wall Street financial world, where inside trading is the sort of standard operating procedure without any underlying asset, right? I mean, it's so when it goes out on a public auction, as it did in this case, it becomes like an IPO where everybody wants in suddenly, and the prices get bid up.
I think that's right, and when you get a critical mass of people who are invested in an artist's market, it is in their interest, isn't it, to prop up that market.
You've met Jacob Casse. Is he an interesting guy? Is that part of the reason for his skyrocketing?
I met him very briefly at a dinner party once. I mean, he struck me as someone who is a serious artist who, no, it doesn't have some kind of public persona and is not out there trying to be an art star. But I would just add that if you're an artist in your mid to late 20s, you're still developing, you know, you're still in the very early stages of your career. So if one particular body of work suddenly becomes outrageously popular, it's going to be difficult for you to move on from that.
Right. Either the pressure to keep doing that or the internal pressure to, I'm not going to do that anymore, if you have a certain kind of refusenik integrity, I suppose.
Right. You know, in the wake of that, there was quite a bit, as you can imagine, of secondary market, as we say, activity in his work. The pieces.
People had bought one for $5,000. Whoa, I better sell this.
Exactly. So you have to feel for an artist that that's happening to, because A, they have no control over that. B,
they're not making the money.
To add insult to injury, they make no money on the secondary market.
Yeah. Sarah Douglas, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sarah Douglas is the culture editor of the New York Observer, and at studio360.org, you can see some of Jacob Casse's work, including the painting that sold for $290,000.
I'm taking care of a business, like they say, green is business. They say, oh, boss, green in a funny way. Comes all the way in a circle is what I mean. It all starts and finishes with green. Right?
Green is a lick, no matter where you place it.
Green
is a color today, always been facing. The
green
on my scene change every day.
The letters doing to you, they say.
In the fall, when Hasbro releases a new version of the board game Monopoly, the paper play money will be gone, replaced by a computer that acts as the bank. But otherwise, Monopoly will remain pretty much exactly the same as it was when it first appeared in 1935, which is to say, really out of date. It no longer jives with the way real estate investing and capitalism works these days. And no more exciting to play than it was when you were 8. So we at Studio 360 decided the game needed a major, more than superficial overhaul. Last month, we asked you, our listeners, for suggestions of how to redesign Monopoly.
What's that you say? Oh man, no way.
We're reading headlines of the Greek government needs to be saved by taxpayers. That's basically a get-out-of-jail-for-free card in Monopoly. What an excellent way to modernize get-out-of-jail-for-free card with a too-big-to-fail card.
In my game, you pick up a chance card, and then it reveals to you this discovery of something real-world-ish, like underground contaminants, or you have asbestos in the walls, or you are subject to the impact of global climate change, or you've incurred localized flooding.
I do play a lot of modern board games, what are often called Euro games, and I thought that if there were more strategic trade-offs in Monopoly, another level to the game, that it would work a lot better. So I made the suggestion that instead of just buying real estate, you could also buy political influence.
We gave all those ideas to world-class professional game designer Brenda Brathwaite, who has been working busily to create our new game. Welcome back, Brenda.
Thank you.
So this is still a familiar-looking game. The dynamics and moves and everything are familiar, but how have we changed the underlying fundamentals of Monopoly?
So the object of the original Monopoly is the player with the most money wins. But in order to do that, you've got to run all the other players into the ground. So the object is really run the other players into the ground. The object of this is to be the first player to $1 billion. And by doing that, you don't have to run anybody into the ground. You just have to run the race the fastest.
Tell us about your game.
Well, so I named it, I'm calling it Boom after the, I guess it has probably a triple meaning, maybe even more than that. But I'm calling it Boom based on the famous video game Doom.
Doom, yeah.
Boom, I like the idea that the economy goes boom. I like the idea that people are in boom cycles. And, you know, that's what it's all about. And the biggest change I guess I've made is I got rid of the properties. I changed them to intellectual properties instead of physical properties. And this, I feel like, resonates way more now, you know, especially, you know, out here where I'm based in the Silicon Valley area, where real estate has really taken a dive. Having these, you know, boom companies, for instance, I suggested Apple and Google as Park Place and Boardwalk. And, and then some other tech companies are on there, some consumer goods, you know, McDonald's is there, Coca-Cola, Starbucks. I've got big oil there and I've got big investment. And so those have replaced the properties.
And they're
divided
into to sectors. You have a tech sector, a green sector, a vice sector, and big oil. And I loved Vice because it combines both R.J. Reynolds and Playboy.
Yeah. You know, we were pretty pleased with that. You know, that was Ian Schreiber. In fact, he said almost the exact same thing. I said, I feel like we need, you know, Vice in there because Vice is just always hot, right? You know, it doesn't really matter where the economy is going. Vice is still doing okay. This would be a good time to mention that the railroads, the beloved railroads, have been changed to engines. And this is probably the largest game rule change. And basically, the way this one works is the first time you land on what would have been a railroad, so you're landing on an engine, the engine cars are shuffled, and one is flipped there, and it's flipped face up. And so this puts that sector of the economy into a boom state. So it's two times as much earnings.
And the boom and bust for a particular sector, that happens by chance, essentially.
Once you land on that engine is in boom state until that boom state stops, and it can happen one of two ways. Somebody else can land on another engine, in which case they're reshuffled and out comes the next boom. Or through a news alert, something could happen which causes the sector to go into crash. People can also do things to one another through community chest that would cause a sector to go into crash as well, or to go into boom. There's multiple ways for things to change, but in many cases, when you do one of these sector changes, you're not just affecting yourself, you're affecting others as well.
So among all the suggestions from listeners and experts, which ones did you decide to try to incorporate?
So a lot of listeners suggested that we implement Eurogame mechanics. And, you know, that's a name that's applied to this large collection of board games like Settlers of Catan or Ticket to Ride. And many of these games, you're all having fun till the end. That is totally in this game. A lot of people also asked for co-op play. They didn't want, you know, they didn't want to come in and, you know, destroy everybody.
All these games socialist are public radio listeners.
Well, you know, but those games are way more fun.
And although some people wanted to, because we all think of banks now as this very different entity than we did back in 1935 when Monopoly was invented, people wanted the bank to be a player. You decided that would be too troublesome?
I did. Yeah. So lots of people did suggest that they wanted to have a way of setting the interest rate and being able to play the bank. Instead, what I did is I incorporated what I thought their desires were, into the community chest cards. And this is the hand, I've renamed those the handouts. So it might be you handing out some stuff to other people, and it might be people handing out stuff to you, which could include, you know, the bank decides to cancel your debt. Yay! So, you know, or the bank decides to jack interest rates and you now owe fees of $4,000 or something like that. So
you've supplied the desire. Exactly, and supplied that level of financial reality in the 21st century.
Exactly.
But it is, because of these basic central rule changes, a different game that, frankly, I'm eager to stop talking to you right now and go play. I've never felt excited to play Monopoly in about 40 years.
Yay. It was a blast, and I hope people enjoy it.
Well, Brenda Brathwaite, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
You can see our redesigned Monopoly game board, the Boom Edition, along with the rules on how to play at studio360.org. Coming up,
everybody hurts.
Sometimes Michael Stipe and REM tell it straight.
I'm charged with being a little didactic and professorial, which I admit, yes, I can be a little bit of the advice guy from time to time, sadly.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Don't go away. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. And this coming Monday, May 23rd, Studio 360 is going to be live on stage in New York City. And wherever you are, you can watch it live on your computer. Our guest for the night will be the fantastic band Toon Yards, the very funny comedian Eugene Mirman, and Prozac Nation writer-turned-lawyer Elizabeth Wurtzel. That's Monday, May 23rd at 7:30 Eastern Time. Go online at studio360.org to watch the special live webcast. Even after they became global superstars, the band REM never quite did the conventional pop mainstream thing, which had a lot to do with the band's frontman, Michael Stipe. There was his singular voice and those strenuously earnest lyrics, but also his passion for design and filmmaking. For 30 years, REM has released videos that are as distinctive as the band's music. Advertisements for songs, sure, but also ambitious, sometimes experimental films. For their newest album, Collapse Into Now, the band commissioned a short film for every song on the record, each one by a different director. The directors range from Albert Maysles to James Franco, and most of the videos are already up on YouTube. I asked Michael Stipe why, in this post-MTV video age, he still spends so much money and energy doing this.
There were kind of two things that I had in mind. One was a way to present a body of work that holds together and that can be looked at as a body of work slash album, or can be looked at as individual pieces. This is something that, when I speak to my goddaughters who are under the age of 17, they have no concept of what an album is.
I know it well.
Or what it was in the 1970s, what it meant to me and to my generation and to the generation of, let's say, Kurt Cobain. It's a very different thing now. We're talking about downloads and we're talking about YouTube. It's 2011. Let's face up to that.
And the videos, in some way, you think helps reestablish the idea of the album in the old-fashioned way?
I think it does. I mean, it's a very we live in a very visual culture, and I'm referring to them as films rather than videos, because
okay.
A video to me is really a thing of the past. I feel like as a format, it's largely dead. Now, it exists and it lives for people like Lady Gaga and Kanye West, both of whom I admire immensely. But it's not something that REM should be probably trying to do in 2011.
Do you have an issue with people experiencing your songs for the first time lashed to a set of images, as opposed to just hearing it?
Yes, I do have a problem with that. But that said, it's one of those kind of inevitable compromises that one has to make, I think, in order to get your work out there and to get people seeing it and hearing it. I mean, ideally, I think, you know, for me, as a music fan, I know what I go to music for. I know what it provides for me. What I don't necessarily need is someone else's visual take on what a song means to them or what they think it should mean to me. I'd like to establish that myself.
Uh-huh.
But I have to hear the song first. And right now I think the way to do that is to have it popping up in people's pockets,
right,
on their portable devices.
One of my favorite films of this suite of films is, mm-hmm, is the one that goes with Every Day Is Yours to Win.
Thank you.
Which made by
Jim McKay.
It's this collage of apparently homemade YouTube videos of all kinds, intimate and odd. A guy voguing, a guy putting on makeup, a guy hitting his bare chest, a teenager crying. It's very tender for this collection of odds and ends.
With the walk and the talk and the tick-tock clock. With the rock and the roll.
I had a sense that Jim McKay, of all people, could take that song and interpret it in a way that might come close to what I wanted, what I imagined.
I cannot tell a lie. It's not all cherry pie, but it's all there waiting for you. Yeah, you. Hey, yeah. Hey,
that's Every Day Is Yours to Win, which is a wonderful song. It seems as if you were addressing it to an individual, perhaps a goddaughter or something.
No.
No?
No. No, it's a little more general than that.
Yeah?
Yeah.
But did it begin with the germ of, I want to give a little tiny bit of hope to people if I can?
I think so. I mean, I'm charged in the past as a public figure and also as a big mouth. And also as a singer and lyricist, I'm charged with being a little didactic and professorial, which I admit, yes, I can be a little bit of the advice guy from time to time, sadly. This song would probably, for the naysayers, fall into that category. But I'd like to think that, for me, the song is largely about success, and it's about success being something that is not judged externally but internally. And so with one of the main themes of the record, Collapse Into Now, being about an attempt to stay in the present moment or an attempt to recognize the present moment for what it is. This song is, I think, a very important part of that whole.
There's another song in the record called Me and Marlon Brando, Marlon Brando and I. I want to play a little bit of that.
Sure.
And talk about it.
We live and dream about the future. Please ask Neil, I need to bow well now. Sift through the annals of our flavored times, our heroes and all their fatal flaws. Me, Marlon Brando, Marlon Brando, and I say, lay me down, 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 lay me down, 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 down.
So, explain.
What do you want to know?
What's the story behind that song?
Well, I wrote it about a conversation that I had with Neil Young, which I made up. The conversation didn't actually happen. But I wrote it about a conversation I had with Neil Young about fame and about Marlon Brando and about human tendencies and the contradictory nature of being human.
Mm-hmm. The video for this, or rather the film for this one, has this beautiful footage of Brando in his,
right,
40-ish in 1967, which is a Maisel's Brothers piece of film.
That's,
yeah?
Right.
How did you work with the Maisels? How did that happen?
We finished the record in Nashville, and I re-sang the song the last day of mixing the record, which is typical for me, but it's not typical for normal recording artists. You don't really do that while you're mixing. But I wasn't completely happy with the vocal take, and I wanted to nail it in one take, and so I did. We mixed the song. The record was finished. We all had a cognac and got on a plane and went off in our different directions. I came to New York, and I was invited to the dinner party of a friend, and I arrived there, and Albert Maisels was there. We were sat at the kitchen table talking, And I said, what are you working on? And he said, I'm working on a film that I shot in the 1960s that I'm going to re-release next year on a DVD, and it's Marlon Brando. And my jaw dropped, and I've met Albert before, but I said, oh, we have to have a meeting. And through that, he and Bradley Kaplan put together this beautiful, beautiful film from this DVD that they're going to release soon, which is called Meet Marlon Brando.
You said that your songs are mostly not autobiographical, but the opening track on this album called Discoverer definitely is. It's a celebration of New York City.
It sure is.
How did that come to be written?
Like most of the great songs of ours, anyway, I had no idea what it was going to be about. I had no idea that it was coming. It kind of flew out of me, and I got it down on paper. And actually, I didn't. I got it down on my iPhone. But I wrote it down instantly, and then I edited it into something that made sense. But the song is my Valentine to New York, and what the city meant to me as a young man in my early 20s. And it describes a certain moment one evening when I was at a party and someone had bought a bottle of Stolichnaya, I think, or it might have been Moskovskaya. It was a Russian vodka that was not readily available in the early 1980s. And the guy at the party had an espresso machine, which was also very unusual.
How early 80s of the moment.
And I discovered a shot of ice-cold vodka chased by a shot of espresso. And, you know, I was 23 probably, and became incredibly drunk and very aware of it, and wandered in my memory. I was walking west on Houston, down the middle of Houston Street, hammered, but looking up at the buildings and the city, and recognizing what the city has offered to artists and to creative people who come here from all over the world, and what it was now offering to me. And I took that moment and I seized it. Of course, now it took me 25 years to write about it, but that's okay.
And the great thing about your writing, about any narrative artist, is that there's this cupboard with stuff kept, and you never know when you're going to come across that old can back there.
Yeah. We had a song called Disturbance at the Heron House, and I have no idea what that – I had written it in a notebook before there were computers and before I could carry around a typewriter. But I carried that phrase around with me for 7 years before it became a song, and – by the time it became a song, I had no idea why I had written it down, but I just liked the sound of it.
You've said you didn't know anything about music when you started doing this at 20. You didn't know the difference between a bass guitar.
Bass guitar, I know. That's really true. It sounds so stupid, but it's actually true. I knew that the bass guitar had four strings, and that's how. But I didn't know it made this. I didn't know it made the low notes.
So you didn't know bassists were looked down upon either. I guess probably
not Mike Mills.
So how did you become the lead singer of a band? It sounds crazy. Let's just start a band. Hey, what's that?
Well, at 15, I bought the record "Horses" by Patti Smith on the day of its release. I went home. I listened to it all night long, and that morning I went to school and decided that's what I'm going to do. So at 15 years old, I had this unbelievably naive, innocent teenage dream of what I was going to do with my life. I actually had the audacity to carry that out, or whatever it is. I mean, and as it turns out, you know, I later found out I had a modicum of talent and a voice, and I'm not a bad writer. And so when that works well, you know, I just feel very lucky that I found people that were able to put up with me, especially in the early years when I was really what you refer to as mumbly. I was unbelievably shy. It would be as difficult for me to sit here as we are right now looking you in the eye. At the age of 20, it would be impossible for me to have done.
And
I'm still incredibly shy. I mean, I saw someone who I really
see that.
Admire 3 days ago at this event, and I could not approach him to save my life, could not approach the guy. I admired him. I couldn't walk up and say hello.
And yet, as a kid, you had the hubris to say, I'm going to be the lead singer of a band.
It might have been my most courageous act in my life.
During the 80s and 90s, as you were becoming a big rock star, right, and all this curiosity about, well, is he gay? What's going on there?
Right.
Which was probably from a career standpoint difficult to, should I be frank? What is the truth?
Right.
If you were 23 today or 28 today in this relatively more tolerant society in that context, would it be easier, do you think?
Wildly more so. I mean, I think kids today, and when I say kids, I'm talking about 15 and 16, 17-year-olds, don't have the same delineation of sexuality that we grew up with. And basically, the 1980s were a very difficult time for my generation because I came into my sexuality as a teenager. I was well aware at the age of 15 that I liked and enjoyed having sex with men and with women. To what degree, I did not know. And what I really wanted throughout my life was just to basically have, you know, I don't want to say the captain's platter, but I wanted to have any possibility open and available to me. And it was. But in the 1980s, with the advent of AIDS and Reagan and Bush Sr. and everything that brought, and kind of a clampdown of not only gay liberation that was just beginning to happen in the late 70s, following feminism and women's liberation, following civil rights, all the things that the 60s brought were starting to come true. And that door just shut, you know, with Reagan and with AIDS. The 80s were a very difficult time. Did that answer your question?
It did answer my question.
You know, I, as a private person, I feel like I give so much of myself through the work that I do.
Mm-hmm.
There are things that I always kind of felt were super private. And anyway, the captain's platter that I discussed earlier, I fell in love 13 years ago. I met a guy in the south of France, and we've been together ever since. And that closed the door for me of other possibilities.
Of the surf and turf, not other captain's platter.
Yeah, that's a disgusting, I think. I don't even like lobster. But
50 or 60 years into the rock and roll age, is it harder for musicians in 2011 to do something new and that isn't in some sense a cover of something that's been done before?
No, everything's been done before. I mean, that's that. I'm discovering now. I've been working a lot in the plastic arts and making sculpture. I'm having to define what sculpture is for me. I don't really even know. But the more I do, the more I realize that everything that I am like so excited about, because I've just created something, I'm looking at it, I can touch it. It's not a song. It's actually a tangible thing. And I'm so excited about it. And then I find out,
oh, look, Brancusi and Giacometti.
Well, they did that. They did that 80 years ago or in the 60s.
What's your work like?
Right now, I'm working in plastic, and I'm working in...
So literally the plastic arts.
Yeah. I'm working in plastic, and I'm working in plywood, birch plywood that's so beautiful. And there are themes that I'm following in that work, similar to writing songs and similar to you know, lyric writing.
So at some point, will you call yourself a sculptor as well as a musician?
I guess. I mean, I'm a little embarrassed by the term now, but when I met Warhol, he said, "What do you do?" And I said, "I'm a singer in a band." And he said, "Oh, you're a pop star." And I said, "No, I'm a singer in a band." And he said, "So you're a pop star." And I was like, "No, I'm a singer in a band." And actually, Andy Warhol was right.
As in so many ways.
Four years later, Losing My Religion came out, and I was a pop star. And
there you
he
go.
Saw it before anyone else did.
And you weren't famous for just 15 minutes.
Yeah, apparently.
Michael Stipe, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey, now, take your pills. And hey, now, make your breakfast. Hey, now, comb your hair and off to work.
Michael Stipe is the singer and lyricist for REM. Their new record is Collapse Into Now, and to see some of the videos we talked about and hear more of my conversation with Michael Stipe, go to our website, studio360.org. Coming next, we get extremely up close and personal with one of America's great 20th century writers, William Styron.
My father was not sweet. It was a teasing mode, but it was way over the top. Pull your socks up and hold your breath and don't show that you're scared.
Alexandra Styron reconsiders the author of Sophie's Choice. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Let's talk about all our friends who lost the war and all of the novels that had yet to be written about them.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Back in 1967, just about when I was deciding I wanted to be a writer when I grew up, one of the big serious novelists of the age had a great new bestseller. William Styron published The Confessions of Nat Turner, which won the Pulitzer Prize. And then, a few years later, he published his most famous book, Sophie's Choice, which became a huge movie as well. William Styron was as successful and famous as an American writer could be. But the last 25 years of Styron's life until his death in 2006 were a lot less grand. He fell into a miserable depression and didn't publish another novel. A new memoir by his daughter Alexandra gives us maybe the fullest picture yet of his life before and after, certainly the most intimate. It's called Reading My Father. Al Styron, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt.
So you started this short piece that grew into this book 4 years ago. Is writing a book about your father and you something you'd ever thought of doing before?
Not in a million years.
Really?
Yeah. You know, I hate to not to be callous, but, you know, I was done. I was done with my father for a while. So I was the last person on earth I would have thought would turn around and end up spending 3 years investigating him.
And were you thinking as you were deciding, yeah, I'm going to do it, what would Daddy think?
I was more concerned about the living than the dead.
Your mother and your siblings.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I had some real panic attacks when I first started. I thought, I can't do this. You know, I can't. How am I going to tell this story and tell it straight and have it be okay?
Yeah.
Going down to Duke to explore my father's archives was really an effort at trying to excavate some memories, enough to actually create a book.
All his papers and manuscripts and notes and everything are at Duke University.
Yeah, 22,500 pieces. For me, it was sort of a hunting expedition to go down there the first time. And it was overwhelming, the amount of stuff down there. But
What struck you most or surprised you or shocked you? Or
well, I think certainly the most shocking thing and the most distressing thing that it turned out to be the key that turned the engine on this book was finding not one unfinished novel that he had struggled with and I knew he'd struggled with, but four or five. And there were these, you know, this wealth of manuscripts down there that were all in a sort of terrible mess.
And weirdly, chaotically numbered and arranged.
Yeah. I mean, they were sort of a metaphor for his troubled mind. And I didn't realize how hard he had tried to pull out of his soul another great novel. And that was his life's work. And that's what he couldn't make happen in the last 25 years of his life. And that all of a sudden, this picture came clear to me, you know, the sort of image became revealed. And I thought, this is horrible. And this is the key to the story of what happened to Bill Styron.
He wasn't just not writing.
Yeah.
He was failing to write.
He was failing to write in a way that was epic and tragic,
right,
and devastating.
Let's talk about living with one of the great novelists of our time, capitals, all capitals, as one of your friends calls them, whom you quote, the big babies. At what age were you aware of this parade of cultural giants, Norman Mailer, Vladimir Horowitz, Tom Stoppard, Leonard Bernstein, Kurt Vonnegut, on and on and on, that these were the guys in your house?
I don't know. I think I understood it pretty early. I mean, I was relatively precocious, and I was, much younger than my siblings. So I grew up in northwestern Connecticut in a little town where, you know, it's what's not like growing up on the Upper East Side or in Brooklyn today, where everybody is an artist and everybody's successful and everybody's creative. You know, it was a working class slash middle class town, and
we were full of these cultural superstars dinner at your house.
And Arthur Miller lived nearby, and there were a couple of other people like my father, but mostly, you know, those were people who came from New York to visit. We were weirdos in our town. So I was aware of the fact that we were different, and I was aware of the fact my parents' friends were different.
And Albert, your name is Alexandra, a very beautiful name. He called you Albert. Why?
Yes.
Why, how come?
He could be quite sweet. You know, he could be monstrous, but he could be quite sweet and tender. And he liked to, he had his little intimacies with all of us, and that was one of them with me.
Speaking of quasi-monstrous, I used to worry that I would take my jokes with my small children when they were small too far. What your description of your father made me think I was nowhere near the line. Yeah. of these scary things he would tell you and insist that they were true and creep up behind you with his eyes rolled back. And it sounds a little terrifyingly beyond Adam's Family-ish.
Yeah, well, it was. It was a little, I guess, like they say, you know, the real Grimm's fairy tales are, you know, really, truly awful. And they... you know, they're not sweet. They don't have sweet endings. And my father was not sweet when he was in his – it was a teasing mode, but it was way over the top. And the job – I mean, I always felt like my job was to not let him know that I was scared. So it was sort of like this weird game that was set up. He'd terrify – you know, he'd tell you a horrible story and you had to kind of bite your lip. It wasn't military, but it had an aspect of you know, pull your socks up and hold your breath and don't show that you're scared.
The book, it does this very difficult trick of being very frank and honest and yet sympathetic and loving. Did you worry about the lines you have to cross early on? For instance, you say, my father was a monumental to everyone close to him. Did that just... feel difficult to write and say the world's going to see me saying this?
No, because I felt like I knew how I was going to temper that. I felt like, you know, you just go out there and say it. But if you say it right and you then tell the rest of the story, I think, you know, find me somebody, you know, who doesn't at some point say my father was an
Our children don't.
I feel sort of like that's how you bring your readers in. Then you also layer that with love.
It is not Daddy Dearest.
It is not Daddy Dearest.
What role do you think his prodigious drinking played in his work and his life and the functioning of your family?
Well, I suppose when my father was younger that liquor was something which actually greased the wheels in some ways. I think, you know, like many artists, they use various substances to access their creativity and their deeper soul. So, you know, living with somebody who was – he was not a fall-down drunk alcoholic. He wasn't that kind of drinker.
He was a classic 1950s, 60s drinker.
Right.
Who would now be put in an institution.
Yeah. Right. Back then, they were just mom and dad. I think – he needed it, and then it betrayed him.
When did you read his novels? When had you read the Paul Ouvre?
Well, as I write about in this book, I my first attempt was when I was 12, and I started to read Sophie's Choice because it was coming out, and I had a copy of The Galleys, and I wanted to be cool.
You were 12.
Yeah, I was 12, and I wanted to be cool and grown up and show that I could read my father's work, and I was very quickly. So horrified by the sex scenes that I put it aside. And I did not read Sophie's Choice for 25 years. But I read, I probably by my mid-20s, I had read all of his major work. I hadn't read everything. I wasn't really until the last few years that I think I read everything.
And reading the sex scenes in Sophie's Choice at 12, was it – I mean, it makes for a great passage in the book. Was it actually just a mortifying
– Mortifying. Yeah. Mortifying. I mean, you know, what could be a worse age to realize that not only do your – you know, does your father probably have sex, but he knows about it, and he knows about it in graphic detail in a way that you don't. And I was absolutely – I wanted to die.
He's gone now, and you're a writer yourself. As you went back to read his fiction as you were writing this book, could you read it with more objectivity? Or is he still your dad?
No. I think one of the things that was sort of wonderful about the experience of writing this book is that I saw him in so many ways objectively for the first time. I saw his work objectively, but I saw him as a man objectively in a way that is fantastic. I mean, this book I wasn't looking to forgive him. That was not on my agenda at all. But there's nothing like taking in a person in all their dimensions and getting lost in the story of what made someone who they were, to separate yourself from them as a child and look at them and either admire or dislike them, but actually see them for who they are.
Paul Styron, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Alexandra Styron's new memoir is called Reading My Father.
Why in the night sky are the lights hung? Why is the earth moving round the sun? Floating in the vacuum with no purpose, not a one. Why in the night sky are the lights hung? Oh, 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 oh.
Some people finally get to doing what they're truly passionate about late in life. But for others, the spark sparks when they're young, and they go for it. Karim Rashid designs ordinary household objects. Colorful plastic, a little groovy, and on sale pretty much everywhere. Such as the Umbra O chair and the Garbo trash can. Rashid, who was born in Egypt and grew up in Canada, is one of those people who found his calling early on.
Well, when I was a child, I was very quiet, believe it or not, and quite introverted. A lot of people would find that hard to believe, I guess. And I would hide under the bed, basically, and draw for 6 hours straight. And I loved to draw. And what I would draw, basically, is little utopias of worlds that I wanted to live in. My little utopia. And I'd actually draw little, buildings and little architectural structures and little vehicles that would contain your entire house in them, almost like RV vehicles and things. And then I started loving to draw physical things. And I remember drawing all my mom's shoes and eyeglasses in the house, the stereo in the house. When I was about 5 or 6, we took a ship from London to Montreal, the Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth, and that journey was, 10 days or something. And there was a drawing competition on the ship, and there were, because there was a lot of people on the ship, there were about 300 children, so we all had to draw something. And, most children drew things like their family or the boats or the sun and landscapes. And I drew luggage. And I drew luggage because I was fascinated with this idea that we took our entire home and put it in a few crates and we were moving to the new land, to Canada. I mean, it was a really primitive drawing of kind of weird things trying to stuff, the shoes go here and the clothes go here and all that. But that kind of was probably the first time I actually tried to really design something, And I won the competition, by the way, which that's the only degree I have up on my wall, really, is a little plaque from when I was 5. If I can make something function beautifully and really well, I can almost get away with any sort of expression. So I make sure now that if I'm doing things that are kind of, a bit radical or a bit kind of, let's say, what I would call inspiring, because I think things around us need to be inspiring and give us a feeling that we're more alive, etc., they got to work really, really well. And if they work, you kind of, in a way, met all the criteria, let's say, of what design is really about. A lot of times I find those simple ideas, in a way, the most powerful ideas. And they're really about, as designers, about being obviously very observant of behaviors, the way we do things. And you can see solutions very easily. I did a credit card for Visa, and I put 2 stripes on the card. So you could use the card either way. So you don't, you know. And then I even realized that, but it was too expensive for them to produce, was to put four stripes, two and two. So it doesn't matter how you use a card, it will always work. You know, these are very, really simple. And the process of design is interesting. If you do these things in a very, like, they seem obvious, but if you do them, they allow you actually to shape new form or new aesthetics or new ideas. I am so interested in the new, in the world we live in now. You know, not only is it my field, it's in my DNA. It's the way I live. You know, if I could have a microchip in my hand, which, by the way, FDA approved 2 years ago, that I can wave to open up all my doors, even my car door, I love that because I hate keys. If I could get rid of the passport and just use my iris, I would be more than happy with my fingerprint. I don't want to carry around something that I'm afraid perpetually I'm going to lose, because that adds stress to my life. I'm always interested when the archetype is finally broken or terminated in a way. And we live with archetypes, you know, and we keep revisiting them over and over and over again. And, you know, even something like the laptop, the notebook computer, we've been hanging on to that archetype for 20 years. It's more or less still the screen opens up with the keyboard in front of you. So it's amazing that this stuff just stays and stays and stays until somebody, just one person, one company, just breaks the archetype and moves us to the next level. And that's the part I'm kind of fascinated with design. So if I had to think of objects that I love, they'd be, I guess, things that would break the archetype and really make us live in the moment in which we exist. I just did luggage this year for a company, and it's just actually going into production very soon. Most luggage right now is just a big empty volume, and you just mix everything in there. So again, I went back to this idea of compartmentalizing things, which is what I did as a child. When I travel, for example, now, I wear like shoes that have no shoelaces. I never wear a belt when I go through the X-ray. I'm all prepared. So I thought about luggage that way, in the same way. You know, what could just make this whole experience a little bit easier? Make an object remove stress from our lives, because a lot of objects add stress and we put up with it.
Karim Rashid has over 3,000 objects in production. You can check out some of them at studio360.org. Was there ever some aha moment that launched you on a particular creative path? If so, we'd like to hear about it. Tell us at studio360.org. And that does it for this week's show. Don't forget, you can also subscribe to our free podcast, get new daily dispatches at our website, and follow us on Twitter at Studio360Show and at KB Anderson. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Millar,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Michael Guerriero,
Sarah D'Elia,
Mary Du.
And thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiga.
PRI Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, David Simon, creator of The Wire, explains what he's trying to do with his latest urban TV drama.
We're after the living city of New Orleans.
Now in its second season, Tremé revels in New Orleans music.
It's actually the culture that saved the city.
David Simon on his HBO show Tremé. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.